Solation Audio. Sturdy answers, better souls.
Donald and I, 2 years ago, two summers ago, started an organization called Solation. It's a word we made up, kind of like the way the tissue company made up the word Kleenex. And Solation is the idea, if you think of it, like soul celebration, soul foundation, soul formation, Solation. And it is for the purpose of showing how the good news of Jesus Christ affects our souls so that we can develop the same kind of soul that Jesus had. Because our point in life is not necessarily to reproduce Jesus. God put you on the world because he wants Bob and Bill and Sally and Russ. That's who he wants in this world. He wants us to have the kind of characters he designed us to have in Eden. And when Jesus Christ stepped on the planet, he came to be the second Adam to restore in us what was lost in Eden. So Solation is to bring the good news of Jesus, not just so we go to heaven when we die, but that we can have a little bit of heaven in our souls here right now as we live out the Great Commission and the good news. So that's what John and I do, traveling around the country. And one of the audiences we enjoy speaking to the most are students, college students, high school students, because their questions are white hot and they haven't been quite jaded enough by the world to put on, you know, the sourpuss face and to think that, well, there may not be anything for me. I've been too wounded to pursue these things anymore. So college students and high school students are really, you know, some of our favorite audiences. They're fearless with their questions and they have a deep hunger to know what reality is like and how to fit in with it. They really do. Even though statistics are that so many walk away from the faith, there's still deep within them a hunger for finding a coherent view of reality. They really want it. And I'm afraid that for many, when they go into the church or they go and they talk to their, you know, Christian community or Christian neighbors or whatever it may be, they do get the subjective view that, you know, when Jesus comes in, he changes the way the feelings are within you. It isn't a matter of Jesus Christ is true because of reasons X, Y, and Z. Now we have to deal with that. I want to share with you a little bit of a story. I actually read it today on the airplane by an author named Kathleen Norris, a brilliant writer. She's talking about how she went into these elementary schools to teach poetry, teaching them about metaphor and similes. For one assignment, she told her class, fifth graders, I want you to write a poem using the experiment with metaphors and similes like I've taught you today. So one of the fifth graders started writing out a poem, and this is what he wrote. It's entitled, My Very First Dad. I remember him like God in my heart. I remember him in my heart like the clouds overhead and strawberry ice cream and bananas when I was a little kid. But the most I remember is his love as big as Texas when I was born. He remembers him like God in his heart, like strawberries and ice creams and bananas. But the most I remember is his love as big as Texas when I was born. When Kathleen Norris spoke to that student's teacher, the teacher said, this is one of the poorest students in my class. He does terribly on his homework. He doesn't pay attention in class. As a matter of fact, his very first dad left him on the day he was born. He never knew him. This is what Kathleen Norris says about that conversation. She says, oddly enough, hearing this story about this boy was gratifying. Just a poet's presence in that classroom on behalf of similes and metaphors had allowed this boy to tell the adults in his life, his teacher, his mom, his stepfather, something they need to know. That a very first dad looms large in his psyche. Like God in his heart, to quote the poem, a revelation from the depths of this boy's soul. When we travel around and we speak to students, whenever we get to speak a multi-day kind of conference or a retreat or a camp or something like that, we stand up in front of the students on the very first time we get a chance to speak to them and we say, I want you to write down your two most important questions in life. The two most important. The kind that if they were answered, life would be a little bit easier for you. Your two most important questions in life. The ones that if they were answered, life would be a little bit easier for you. Last week we were in New Hampshire speaking at a camp. And these are the stack of cards that we got. We have about 2,500 of these now at home. The questions they're asking are very adult-like. Very adult-like. These are 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. With deep wrestlings of the soul, wanting to find out what they can anchor their lives into. Who made God? How do I not lust after girls? What is the point of believing in God? I mean, I try to, but it's really hard to believe. We want to share a little bit of those questions and how to answer them tonight.
After I got my master's in philosophy of religion and ethics, the same master's that Dale has, I went to teach junior hires apologetics. And I was told that if I could teach junior hires apologetics, I could teach anyone apologetics. And I learned there that a lot of the things in a master's degree don't translate to junior high level. And I gave the students an assignment out of which came later Dale's question that we ask on the road. And I asked them to write down 5 things you don't understand about Christianity. And this was in our third class together. Now, these are 12 and 13-year-olds. I want to read to you some of their questions. Can you get married or do things other than worship God in heaven? Why do we go to church? How can we convince others that our God is real? I don't understand why people say they are Christians but act like non-Christians. I don't understand why people do things that go against the Bible just because other people do them. I don't understand why people read the Bible but don't pay attention to it. I don't understand why people act like total Christians in class and then outside of class they are very different. How do we get to heaven? Why does God continue to love me regardless of my sin? And this one's one of my favorites. What if Jesus was just a really good speaker and not a prophet? I realized in teaching that class that the junior hires had questions that were adult-like, but they didn't have the background intellectually yet to answer them. And part of what we're up against when we're training younger teens, or tweens as they're called, 10, 11, 12-year-olds, is that we have to get them to the point to have the patience to grow into the answers. And they will have to spend time living with their questions, having the patience to know that the harder they pound their feet down, that there are floorboards of their faith to hold them up.
You see how a lady can go into a fifth grade classroom and teach them about poetry and something comes out that was brewing in their soul. And I believe the same thing is happening when you let students really voice their questions. I mean, all the material's right here. What does teen culture wrestle with? I don't just ask them what they wrestle with. They just throw it right at you. Now we have the material. Now we know what's going on in their hearts and their minds. Now we can start addressing it. And that's why I wrote my book called Living with Questions, which is on the table in the back. It was taking 7 of their most important questions that I find that they are asking, the 7 most important, one building on the next one. Like, why does what I believe really matter? What is truth? Is God there? Has God spoken? Am I valuable? Am I good? And what's the big deal about heaven? Which is a surprising thing, since so much of our evangelistic techniques are about heaven, many of our young people don't even see what the big deal is in getting there. Weird. So that's why I wrote my book, because we have this deep concern, you know, and it's my first book. So when you're thinking about, gosh, if I were to write a book, what would be the book I would write? You ever thought that? You know, if I had a pen in my hand and somebody came up and said, write a book that will help change people, I'd be like, I know, gardening? I don't know, you know? And that was one of the things I wrestled with till the need kept presenting itself over and over. And all these questions come in and they're like, what book do you recommend? I really want to read a book. And like, all the books are for adults. You're not going to understand that one necessarily. Or the books are out there that are really deep, but they aren't necessarily addressing your questions the way that you're asking them. And so, I mean, 10,000 emails later answering so many questions, you're like, this needs to go in a book. We need to put this together. So I took a conversational approach with my own life story in it and put together what I think are just tools to help them start thinking and processing the questions that they're asking.
Before we go into what we've learned on the road, we want to be really clear about a disclaimer tonight. The first time Dale spoke about the questions teens were asking and how to answer them, he was inundated by parents afterwards. They came up to him asking him for advice, for tips, so they could fix their son or daughter. And I remember having a conversation with one couple, a husband and wife, and they were frustrated about their teenage daughter. They told us that she was in rebellion. And Dale got not distracted because he wasn't listening, but distracted because other people were asking for his advice. That I was left alone with this couple, and I was talking with them. And as I asked questions, I found out that the rebellion that their teenage daughter was in was that she wanted to get acrylic nails. You know, the kind that, you know, have a French manicure look, and they're long, and they last a while, and sometimes they break, and they hurt. Okay, she wanted to get those. And the mom was really frustrated by that because she thought it would reflect very poorly on her. And I remember thinking, this is the rebellion that we're talking about here. This doesn't have anything to do with apologetics, as far as I can tell. And the more time I spent asking her questions, asking the dad questions, I realized they were there to mold their daughter into their own image. Now, acrylic nails, you can get them for the right reason and the wrong reason, but that wasn't the point. The point is, and this is what I want to ask you tonight, is why did you come tonight? Chances are you know someone, a teenager, a student, who's struggling, and you want to reach them. And we commend you for that. We love that. But something that we're concerned about tonight is that all the tactics and the tips and the ideas and the practical advice into reaching the postmodern youth goes for nothing if we are not joining our yoke with Christ. My father gave me some really good advice when I was beginning to date guys. He said, don't date a fixer-upper. And I think that's good advice to give you as parents. We're not parents yet, but I think that's good advice. We don't want to treat our children as if they're fixer-uppers. They're made in God's image, and sometimes they reflect God's image in ways we're not comfortable with. And getting acrylic nails is not the same as doubting the divinity of Christ, even if we are uncomfortable with that. So we want to gently encourage you to have caution about why you are trying to change the teens or the youth or the students in your life, and to leave room for the Holy Spirit to do the prodding.
Which is an interesting story. Donald and I did a retreat for a group of young people last summer. And something that we are a firm believer in that we see all the time is that students can handle a lot more than we give them credit for. They really can handle some deep stuff. When we were speaking at this camp, they asked us to put together a devotional booklet for the week. So we put together the devotional booklet, then we talked on those topics all week long. And the gentleman who led the whole group is in his mid-40s. We're sitting down at lunch halfway through the week. And he says, you know, Dale, I have to confess to you, when we got that devotional booklet, we thought, oh boy, this is going to go right over their heads. This week is going to be maybe spiritually irrelevant because they're not going to understand this stuff. He's like, but now we're 3 days into this. And they're eating it up. The pastor's son, who was there, came up to us and said, you know, I usually just fly through these things, but this one's really made me think some. I really appreciate the time you guys put into this. I'm like, well, it's nice to hear some appreciation. That's really cool. So this gentleman sitting across the table from me said, you know, I just have to confess to you something. The reason why I thought this was too deep is because I don't want to have to face these issues or these questions myself. Wow. Could it possibly be, as we search our own souls, that one of the reasons we don't get into the muddy nitty-gritty of the life of the American teenager is because we're afraid of what we might find there, and it might confront us with our own issues? They might ask questions that we don't know the answer to and might require us, if we have that, you know, that the prick of guilt of responsibility, that maybe we need to go out and do some study on our own so we have something to hold up the answer that we have to give them. Just maybe. Just think about that. We want to define before we jump into the three questions we want to address tonight, is we want to talk about what postmodernism is, because we use the word a lot, and that's the title of our talk, Living with Questions, Reaching Postmodern Youth. But what on earth is a postmodern? I mean, when we think of modern, we think of up to date. So can something be more up to date than up to date? Are we after the up to date time now? So we want to define for you a little bit of what postmodernism is. So let's do it by just comparing it with compare contrast. The era we're moving out of into the postmodern world is called modernism. There's a big fancy word for you. So modernism is this is the view and the general view, if you think of the Industrial Revolution, modernity, the rise of science and technology, the way everything started to become mechanized, quantifiable, everything is measured. So then now you get on the media, which is still has a lot of a modern kind of feel to it. When you get on the media and talk about what is really true or what is false about the world, they always throw a scientist up there as if he's the high priest of the culture. Because science and natural things are easy to quantify. It's hard to quantify things like literature. How do you quantify or add up Shakespeare? Shakespeare is more of a soulish quality, and that for moderns is not necessarily something that we value as important. What we value is what we can measure, what we can eventually control. So the Industrial Revolution, those who are Christians in it thought that when God said take dominion over the earth in Genesis, they interpreted that as the earth is yours to exploit and to use however you see fit. Brave New World by Aldous Huxley, for those of you who have read it, is a wonderful example of modernity. The modern world breaks everything down to simple atoms and digits and numbers. So that at the end of the day, human beings are not really human beings with a soul. Human beings are just a creative assembly of atomic parts that if you manipulate them enough, they can become machines that serve the people at the top. Enter eugenics. And how we can now control the DNA to try to create different kinds of sheep and animals and one day human beings that we will alter because we believe they are machines. That's modernity. Darlene is going to give an example.
This idea that humans are just meat machines is not just something out in the secular culture. It's inundated our church culture as well. And you see it in the way churches will manipulate our emotions, even in something as good as a worship song. There are actually conferences that worship leaders can go to where they teach you how to use lighting, sound, PowerPoint, even smells in a church setting to create a mood of worship. As if any means justify the ends of worship. And it ends up treating the human being, even the worshipers who come to church hoping for an experience of meeting God, to associate a certain emotional high with meeting God. And as a good friend of ours who we went to church with in Laguna Beach says, he can get that same feeling at a secular rock concert. Meeting God is more than an emotional high, though it can accompany that. But treating a human being as if they were a machine made out of flesh, you put in the right inputs, you get the right outputs, ends up forgetting that we're made in God's image.
So enter postmodernism that looks at the modernist stuff and goes, just get me out of here. I don't want to be treated like that. You guys are using, you know, the media airwaves to put on your experts to say what I am supposed to believe. But what it feels like is a giant, you know, a power struggle. You're just doing that so you can oppress me. Then they walk into the churches. They hear certain sermons that may not be backed up with good facts. And they walk away from that going, you know what? They're just suppressing me with your religious dogma. And so postmodernists step back and say, you know, everybody seems to be pushing their opinion and their ideas on me, how about we just invent truth on our own? That way I could shake off all this ridiculous stuff about whatever other people want me to believe, and I can come to believe things on my own. And that's something of a postmodern attitude. Reality is what you make it, so that nobody can control you anymore. The postmodern looks at the moderns and they think, you know what? They were so concerned about their reputation that they lost sight of their authenticity. So the postmodern will walk in and say, I'm going to work on my authenticity, and I could care less what reputation you have of me. I really don't care what you think. Yeah, I smoke pot. Yeah, you know, I have casual sex at the parties, but at least I'm honest. Have you heard that? My goodness. That is the thing everywhere, as if being honest about being messed up is the ultimate virtue. It's a step towards virtue, but it's not the ultimate virtue. So postmodernism is trying to shake off these trappings, saying I'm more than a machine. Stop trying to manipulate me. Stop trying to control me. I'm just going to go, na, 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 na. I'm inventing my own world, inventing my own world, inventing my own world, and then I can feel better about myself.
And that's why you see things, self-confessional things on the blogs and YouTube, where everyone has their own story. And a lot of it is more about being real than pursuing virtue and truth. And the church has picked up on this, too. Almost every church bulletin or marquee, I see the word real, right? Real people, real stories, real change. The word real itself is a buzzword with postmoderns because genuine authenticity trumps tradition.
And what if it said, like, good doctrine? I'm not going over there, you know.
That's why when I went to school at the University of Virginia, the discussion trumped the lecture. It was more important to be gathered with peers and hear each other's perspectives on the poetry we were reading or the historical incident we were studying. It was more important to hear each other's responses than it was to study the actual poet or historical event. And so you begin to see that there's no grand story uniting us all. It's just individual stories and experiences. And you tell your story, and I'll tell mine, and then we'll go get a cappuccino together. And I think as we share these perspectives on postmodernism, you begin to see some of the problems in it. I think that's kind of obvious. What I want to do is to share a couple of the good things in postmodernism, the things that I think aren't unique with postmoderns, the things that go back to Christ. Number one is the reemergence of story. And Christ was a master of that. Jesus talked and spoke and taught in parables. Also, a beginning to take a step back and say, what is my experience with this difficulty and what can I share to help encourage you? Rather than preaching something that I don't have an experience with, to dig down and find our own experiences being valid to share with those we know and love. And finally, one of the hallmarks to me of the goodness in a postmodern view is that there is a return to humility. Saying, I don't have this down yet, but I'm struggling to become more like Christ. And I think these are some touching points that we can meet the postmodern youth.
And that's why living with questions is so important. It's not the idea that you have it all figured out with your answer. Here it is. Check it off. You have one paragraph. Can you recite it? Therefore, you have it. Time to move on. But living with questions is starting to get answers that are working to your soul. So that faith itself is not a product. There's modernism again. Just sell them product. They're all a bunch of consumers in the church anyway. Just put it in them. We'll keep, you know, faithful followers. But faith is really a process. It's a journey. It's a journey of trust. It's a journey of trusting the trustworthiness of God. That's why walking in faith is such a mystery, because you're not just walking with certain maxims. You're not walking with a certain kind of map where the dotted line is mapped out for you. You're actually walking with a person, the person of God, who may make a turn at any moment, who may ask you to do something at any instant. And that is the great mystery of walking in faith with Jesus. And I think our young people, when they really understand what that means, will begin to crave it. I really believe that when Jesus talked about living water, he was touching on something that's in the heart and soul of every single person, young and old. One of the things we find interesting about apologetics today, and for those of you who don't know what the word means yet, it means to literally give a defense for the Christian faith or to give an answer. And I think one of the things that is deeply needed in apologetics is redefining the old words, the old theological words, blowing the dust off of them and presenting them for what they are. I asked a group of teenagers, 100 of them in the audience, how many of you could tell me what sin is? They know the word. They know how to spell it. And the clearest definition I got was whatever displeases God. I said to the audience, you've told me what sin does, but you haven't yet told me what sin is. So that's my question to you, as you pondered in your hearts. What is sin, and can you define it if you were asked it on a test? I'll give you a clue. St. Augustine is the one who came up with the clearest definition of the theological term sin. He says it is literally a twisting of the good. When you know what goodness is and how it can be twisted, then you know what sin is. Murder is evil because it's a twisting of life. Stealing is evil, it's sin, because it's a twisting of possessions. Lying is a sin because it's a twisting of truth. having other gods before you besides the one true Jehovah God who shows himself to us in a trinity, if you have other gods before you, it's a twisting of following the one true God. So sin is a twisting of what is good. Now, if students understood that, they wouldn't ask all these questions about who created sin or how do I get sin out of my life. Well, they don't know what goodness is, and that's another thing that has to be defined. Glory. They don't know what glory means. Ask yourself in your heart, do I know what glory means? It's one of those words we put in our prayers or we put towards somebody when we want to talk spiritual talk to them. But glory as a word, as a concept, do we know what it is? I'll let that sit on you, and if you have any questions, you can talk to us afterwards. So I want to talk about these three questions. Three questions we want to address tonight. Question one is, what is truth? The second one, how do I know Christianity is the right religion? And the third one is, what's the big deal about heaven? What is truth? How do I know Christianity is the right religion? And what's the big deal about heaven? We want to just give you some hooks on how to think about these things. And you're thinking, yeah, right, he can't do this in 20 minutes. Oh, yeah? That's a challenge. What is truth? One of the leading statisticians in evangelical circles today wrote in a book on teens saying that only 9% of teenagers polled believe there's such a thing as absolute truth. Only 9% believe there's such a thing as absolute truth. And that gets used by a lot of nonprofit organizations to get people to donate money to them because they're going to do the job now of educating everybody in truth. So that's the statistic gets thrown out there. What you're not told is that 8% of young people disavowed or said there was no such thing as absolute truth. 9 said there was absolute truth. 8 said there wasn't. That's only 17% of the kids. What did 83% say? I don't know. I don't know. What is truth? And the questions come in on the cards. What is truth? How on earth am I supposed to answer the essay or the little poll that's given to me? What is truth? We throw words around like absolute truth and truth. Now, how many of us know the difference between those two? Is there a difference between truth and absolute truth? Or do we put the word absolute on it to make it sound more profound? What I can tell you is that to a postmodern, when you use the word absolute, it sounds like, again, you're doing a power struggle with them and you're trying to control them with something. At the end of the day, truth and absolute truth can be used interchangeably, even though philosophers will talk about the definitions of each one. But truth in general, one on earth is truth. Here's a simple definition for you. It's a belief or an idea that links up with the way the world really is. It's a belief or an idea that links up with the way the world really is. For you philosopher types, this is called the correspondence theory of truth. Many postmoderns say, oh, that's a modern idea, but it really goes all the way back to the philosophers even before Jesus' day. It's the oldest view of truth in history. What a belief or an idea that links up with the way the world really is. Here's an illustration. Where did I put my keys? Now, how many of you thought that tonight before you got in the car to come to church, right? You're like, where did I put those? So you're thinking, you have a belief or an idea, where did I put my keys? And then suddenly another idea pops in your head. Aha, when I walked in the door, I put them on the dining room table. Now, that's your belief. My keys are on the dining room table. Doesn't mean they really are, but this is the belief you have in your head. So you walk through the house, you're walking through the kitchen, you know, you stumble over your kids' toys. You get all the way into the dining room, and bam, there on the dining room table are your keys. What is happening here? I have an idea or a belief in my head. The keys are on the table. I have reality over there of the keys being on the table. I know it sounds kind of abstract, but it's like simple as pancakes. Okay, the idea in your head, the keys are on the table. There are the keys on the table. That connection, all of a sudden, that invisible line between my belief and the actual keys is called truth. Woohoo! You passed. Write it on the poll. 100% of the people in this room believe in truth. Truth is that invisible line that links up a belief or an idea with the way the world really is. Every teen believes in truth. Every single one of them. They believe that the person that they're dating actually exists. They do not think that they're dating invisible boyfriends. Hey, this is my boyfriend, Bill. Say hi to Bill. Bill, shake everybody's hands. They don't believe like that because it's absurd. They know it. But they don't know that's what truth connections are. You know, when they get their first car when they're 16, they actually believe when the needle hits E, there's no more gas left. Because the belief that when it hits E corresponds with the reality that there's no more gas left. And they have truth. Truth is all about them. Truth is what they're swimming in. And truth, I believe, is what they really hunger for and they want. They just don't want to be hit on the head with it. And they want to be told clearly what it is so they can follow in it. There's a lot of talk today about truth and whether we can know it in the church today. There's a whole movement that is struggling with this idea of whether we can know truth. And I believe for many, they're just making an appeal to postmodern culture. And a lot of evangelical writers are responding to that movement by saying, no, truth, there's such a thing as absolute truth. It is here. We can know it. And there's all this talk about truth or not truth being beat back and forth. But the question I do not hear raised is, what does the postmodern want in the place of truth? At the end of the day, when they lay their head on their pillow at night and their soul starts to quiet down and the cravings and the hungers of what they really are looking for are there, what do they want in the place of truth? I mean, I suggest to you that what they're looking for is living water. They want life. They want a good life. Why have they heard from the church, or why do they get the impression from the church that if they get truth, they lose life? Have we lost a connection here? Have we been so concerned about having all the right answers for our young people that we forget what those right answers are for? To have life. I want the life of Jesus in me. I don't just want answers. I want answers are a means to an end. I want to live. I want to make sense of things. So when you get in an argument with somebody about truth, take a step back and find out, am I giving life to this discussion? Or am I just trying to be right and trying to disprove the other person? Question number two.
When I was in seminary, Talbot School of Theology at Biola, we batted around the existence of God, because as an apologist, you're supposed to know how to defend God's existence. But that is not the major question teens and students are facing. Most people affirm God's existence. A bigger question is, how do I know Christ is telling the truth? How do I know Christianity is where truth is found? How do I know Jesus wasn't just a good speaker? There is a growing movement to create religion, much like we create our clothing style, where we pick and choose what works for us. And we have a word for that. We call that boutique fill in the religion. So boutique Buddhism takes the bits and pieces of Buddhism that fit me. Maybe a little bit of meditation, maybe a Zen garden, maybe thinking positive thoughts and believing in karma, but none of the other stuff. Because they'll pick and choose a little bit of Christianity and add it to it. So the sort of boutique Buddhism or boutique Hinduism or boutique Christianity is really the culture that the youth are swimming in. So Christianity itself, we have to defend it against other religions, not just against the atheist.
When 9/11 happened, Oprah got on the airwaves and she spoke to her audience, her multi-million audience, and said, I want you to pray to God. Whatever God means to you, we need to have prayer right now. We want whatever God means to you, whether he, she, it, we, or they are to you, pray to God and ask him to come help restore our country. Help him to bring some order here. Help him to console those who lost loved ones. Everybody says, thank you very much. It's very good. Thank you, Oprah, for inspiring us. Let's go home and pray. What would it have been like if Oprah got on the airwaves and said, we've just been struck with a biological warfare, and the bombs that hit us were full of smallpox. Smallpox epidemics are now breaking out. I want you to go out and get a smallpox vaccination, whatever that means to you. If it means go to the movies, if it means massage your neighbor's toe, if it means do the Macarena, whatever smallpox vaccination means to you, go out and get it. Why is it that we laugh at the second one, but we don't laugh at the first one? The first one is just as absurd. When we talk about religious things in our culture today, the word religion, the word itself, snatches religion out of something that could be knowable and real and puts it into the subjective boutique category. It's a religious thing. You know, do you have a little religion in your life? MTV in 2005 had over 21 commercial spots of different religions. You can watch a little commercial on Hinduism, watch a commercial on Buddhism, watch a commercial on Scientology or Mormonism or Evangelicalism, whatever it is. They have all these different spots. And when MTV was asked, why did you do this campaign? They said, well, a lot of our viewers said they want a little bit more religion in their life. We treat religion like it's the ice cream flavors. You go in and say, you know, I'll have, you know, cookies and cream. But how dare you walk into an ice cream shop and say, cookies and cream is more true than the other ice cream flavors. Weird, huh? That's the way people think of religion today. So before we can answer the question, is Christianity the right religion? Or how do we know Christianity is true? We first have to ask the student the question, is it even possible for Christianity to be true? Do you follow the difference? They may ask, how do we know Christianity is true? You want to reply, is it even possible for Christianity to be true? We had to take it out of the ice cream section and stick it over in the medicine section. Because if a smallpox breaks out, we need only one vaccination that can take care of it. And when sin breaks out, there's only one vaccination for that too, which happens to be the cross of Jesus. So we want to ask the question, can Christianity be true? And if it can, then we can start talking about the evidence. I find that right there is the biggest hurdle for many young people to get over. Like, oh, you know, that's religious stuff. Yeah, that's good for me, not good for you. Michael Newdow, who said he wanted to remove under God from the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, was all over the place. We were like, oh no, he's going to remove God under God from the Pledge of Allegiance. I heard him interviewed by John Ziegler down in Los Angeles. John Ziegler was talking to him, and Michael Newdow said, we have to remove it under God from the Pledge of Allegiance because God is a religious idea and Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. God is a religious idea. God is a religious idea. God is a religious idea. He said it over and over and over again. I wanted to call in, but I'm always afraid if I call in, I'm going to sound like an idiot. You ever feel that way? You're like, I know what to say, but when I get on there, I'm going to say dumb stuff, you know? What I wanted to say, if I could get on there, is that God is not a religious idea. You can come to terms with whether or not God exists, apart from any holy book or religion ever telling you so. And it's not fair to compartmentalize out truths and knowledge about the God who created all things and say he's just now put into the ice cream shop, pick and choose whatever you want. It's a dangerous move, but the kingdom of darkness has played a quick one on us. And unless we understand the struggle that our young people are going through with this question, we're not going to really address the question. When you hear teens talk about old religion in these kind of like ice cream kind of terms, call them on the carpet on it. What do you mean by that? When you say religion, what do you mean? Do you think it's just pick and choose religion, or do you think religion can actually be true? I think it would brew up some pretty cool discussions.
One way to get them to think about that more deeply is to ask this question. And here's a question you can put in your pocket. You can talk to someone about this on a plane, in a taxi, someone you know really well. And this is a question I've tried out, and it works as far as getting people to talk about their spirituality. Ask them, is God a person? Because fortunately, we're still in America. And in America, people pray. And praying assumes that there's a person out there to interact with who can hear and who can respond. If they say, oh, what do you mean by person? Give them a definition, like somebody who can think, feel, choose, somebody with a personality. That's a simple definition of person. Usually they will say yes. Yes, God's a person. Okay, the follow-up question to that. First you ask, is God a person? If they say yes, you follow that up with, do you think God cares about what people think about him? And you have to be careful, because if they're a Wiccan, use her. Okay? I'm serious, because you don't want to offend them as you're asking the question. So do you think God cares about what you think about him? And then you'll start to see the wheels turning. Sometimes they'll say, oh no, God's above that. Why would he care? Well, then you have to go back to the first question. If God's a person with a mind, a will, and emotions, and we're people, then there's some similarities between us and God. And I know I care when people think I'm not married to Dale. Or I care.
I care.
The person's having emotions, and they also care about truth and what people believe about them. So that gives you an opportunity to begin to think, help them think of God as a real being, not an energy force, not a higher power who is so removed from us that he doesn't have interaction with us. That really helps. That's helped me a lot in speaking with people about God and his personhood. I want to move to our last question, just for the sake of time. I want to talk about heaven. What's the big deal about heaven? I spoke about heaven to a group of junior hires, and one precocious boy raised his hand and said, Mrs. Fincher, I have a question for you about heaven. Are there going to be guns in heaven, and are there going to be girlfriends in heaven? And at the time, I did not know what to say. I kind of skirted getting an answer out and moved on to something else. And I went home and I talked to Dale about it. And Dale said, that is such a good question. And I said, I know, it was so hard to answer. And he said, no, but do you see what that shows in him? I said, no, I don't. And Dale said, it shows, well, look, think about it, Jonathan. Guns on earth are one of the ways we protect ourselves. So what he was asking is, will we have power to protect ourselves? Will we have power in heaven? And the girlfriends, well, that's him longing for intimacy and love. Both of those find their source in our God. The source of power, the source of love and intimacy. If we define heaven as a place we sit on clouds and play harps and sing endless verses of hymns that seem to so many teens as obsolete, they're not going to want to go. That very word heaven itself needs a refreshment.
You know, it's an interesting concept we have about heaven today, that I don't know if the biblical writers really thought of it in the way that we've cast it out. Most of our descriptions of heaven we have talk about streets of gold and having walls with gems in it, because God can do stuff like that. And most of the descriptions we have about heaven are actually of a new Jerusalem. It's a city of God coming down to men. In fact, the more I understand the scripture, the more I'm getting the impression that heaven is more like a layover place. Like when we came here tonight, we actually went through Salt Lake City and had a layover before we reached our destination. For heaven, for the believer, is a place where it's a disembodied state, where you go before you're resurrected from the dead. And whatever your eschatology is in view of end times, whatever that is about the resurrection and whether you go to be in heaven for a few years while God punishes the earth, whatever it is, we do know, according to Isaiah 65 and Revelation 21, that at the end of all things, there will be a new earth. And God will dwell with us. He made us in a garden, and he will restore that garden. Our final place is a new earth. That's why we love this earth so stinking much. We love mountains, going hiking and biking and fishing. We love the ocean and just trying to play in waves like you're wrestling with a lion or something like that. We love sailing. We love work. We love cold lemonade after working hot in the garden. We love hugs and kisses, and only bodies can give hugs and kisses. We love this earth so much We love being human and in a body so much because that's the way God intended us to be. And when we're talking to our teens and our young people, this idea of heaven sometimes becomes so abstract and so out there and floating around, like Jonathan said, saying, shine, Jesus, shine, for the millionth time. But if there is a new earth, it affirms exactly who we are. You are valuable who you are. You know, they'll ask a question. Why doesn't God just snatch us up right when we get saved? Well, the answer is you weren't designed to be snatched up. It's against your nature to be snatched up. In the last battle, C.S. Lewis, in the very last of the Chronicles of Narnia series, it's an old Narnia and a new Narnia. It's a beautiful picture of the end of the age in our world. But in the old Narnia, there was somebody, a donkey, that put on an old lion skin and pretended he was Aslan, the great king above all high kings of Narnia. And everyone was following the donkey dressed up like the lion. Well, if people didn't bow down to this donkey dressed up like the lion and his monkey friend, who was like the Antichrist, they were thrown into the stable where a great demon would devour them. When the last king of Narnia, Tyrion, was snatched up, he was thrown through the stable door and suddenly realized he had been thrown into a whole nother world. There was green pastures everywhere and rolling hills and tall trees. And there he saw some of his friends running around and some of the talking beasts of Narnia. And as he was looking around with the sheer delight, where every rock, every tree, every blade of grass just looked as if it meant more, he suddenly caught this whiff of air that surrounded him. It was such sweetness that he had never smelled before. Then he turned around and he looked where it came from, and suddenly his face lit up, for there before him stood all his heart's desire, Aslan himself, whom he had served those many long years but had never seen. And Aslan, he saw all his heart's desire. A lot of young people do not understand the idea of hell. They struggle with it. How could a just God send people to hell? And the best answer I can give them is hell is locked from the inside. The reason why those who do not bow their knee to Jesus go to hell is because even if you're standing in pure paradise with streets of gold and palm trees and beaches and everything else you like when you're on vacation, heaven itself would be hell for them, because it is a torment to stand in your enemy's house. Why on earth would you want all the palm trees when they constantly remind you of the enemy that you lifted your middle finger to and said, buzz off? Which is my definition of sin a lot of times to junior hires. It's that serious. Hell is a place people go to because it is more hellish to be in the presence of God than to be completely separated from Him if they do not want to see His face. But all those who want the life of God in Jesus Christ get the life of God. Jehovah in Jesus is the most inclusive God of all the religions because everyone is invited to the feast. Isn't that cool? Students struggle with, you know, I just want, you know, to hang out with my friends. You'd be like, well, hang out with your friends is good, and goodness has its location in God, so that can't be in hell. You're like, I just want to play video games. Well, having fun challenges and entertainment, that stuff is found in God, actually, and that won't be in hell. All the things that we find legitimate pleasures, all the things we find good, cannot be in hell, because they find their source in God. And I think when we help young people understand this, that all the goodness they really desire are just signposts and tastes of what God is like, then it starts to reorganize their thinking to say, aha, He's the one I've been seeking after. It was only caricatures of Him that I rejected.
Well, we're mostly out of time. I want to share briefly two or three things you can do tonight, even with those you love who are struggling. The first is to be shockless, to be a safe place for them, so that they can share their questions with you. The second is to be quick to admit that you yourself need to re-look at some of those old biblical terms like sin and glory and truth. 3 years ago, I started a journey with Jesus about what it really meant to be a woman and a Christian who had the gift of teaching. And out of that journey, I wrote the book Ruby Slippers. And I found that Jesus defended and loved women more than I would have ever put him up to. And it's part of that journey that I'm able to help young women today. But unless I had taken that time to say, I have no clue, and I'm really confused when I look at Deborah in the Old Testament and Paul in the New Testament, unless we push into those questions, we cannot help. The last thing I want to say is that these teens and students are hungry. We have a chance to show them where they can find living water. Holy God, thank you so much for a chance to talk about how good you are and how much relief and safety and peace you give us. Thank you for coming to this dusty earth and walking with us. Thank you for making us in your image. In your name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to My Wife and Me, Dale and Jonlyn Fincher, on Soulation Audio, helping you be appropriately human. To learn more about Soulation, visit us online at soulation.org, soulation.org.